So for a couple more weeks, we are going to be in this series of sermons that we pop into once every summer for a few weeks. Wise Words from a Friend. If you haven't been with us, I won't retell the entire story all over again, but these messages are born out of a booklet that I was given called Friend to Friend when I first started in this role, and those the devotions in this booklet come from Reverend Harold Wynn, who was a beloved pastor here at First Friends for, I think, almost 30 years back in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s. And so there is so much wisdom that he shared those many decades ago that still pertains to our world. And so we're using those and sort of unpacking and expanding the concepts to look at these things again with fresh eyes today. And today we're talking about the squeeze of greed. And you'll find out shortly why I chose the title, The Squeeze of Greed. So reading from this booklet, Friend to Friend, there's the devotional that simply has the title, Greed. And it's one of the ones that mentions someone's name. So if you're, I'm going to say if you're an old-timer, if you're a long-timer at First Friends, if you're a long-timer here, you may recognize this name, right? So we'll find out. So Elizabeth Butcher, I see a few nodding heads. Okay. Elizabeth Butcher, who is past 90 years old, was telling me about packing potatoes in boxes when she was a little girl. Her father would insist on mixing the big potatoes throughout the whole box so that some small, some medium, and some large potatoes would always be on top. How different things are now. So often the nice and best are put on top, and the poorer fruit or vegetables are covered up and concealed. I'm afraid that this generation is thinking about how to cheat rather than how to be honest. And this is called greed. There used to be a saying in the country, a gospel measure. This meant that when a person bought a dozen ears of corn, he would get another ear. When you sold a half gallon of milk, you would give a little extra. Or when you sold a peck of lima beans, you would fill the basket as full as possible. Today, such liberality is almost unknown unless you stop at a roadside stand where people are still living free from the clutch of greed. Greed is like a boa constrictor snake. When it is small, it can be played with, and it seems so harmless, but as it grows, it becomes large and powerful. Some of these snakes grow to be 15 feet long, weighing nearly 200 pounds. Many a person has tried to train these monsters to curl around their body and then, at their command, uncurl themselves to return to the pen where they are kept and fed. Many a snake handler has been crushed to death by these boa constrictors when they resorted to their normal nature of crushing their prey by the mighty muscles in their body. Greed is like the boa constrictor. It will obey you most of the time, but what about the time that it doesn't? There are people who have had their new life squeezed out by greed. Their kindness, thoughtfulness, love of family, tenderness of disposition have been crushed, leaving them like dead people with nothing normal or with little response to friends and family. The Bible says that covetousness or greed is idolatry. Since all of us becomes like what we worship, he who worships money will become lifeless, cold, hard, just like money. Greed has been the course of many persons' downfall and separation from God and heaven, so beware. I had never heard the phrase gospel measure before. So anybody familiar, you don't have to raise your hand high, but it may be some. Okay, so I wasn't the only one. I read that phrase, and I'm like, I have never heard of getting a gospel measure when it comes to produce. And so I found it fascinating that there was a term associated with the word gospel that carries with it this idea of extra, of overabundance, of having more than what was asked for, paid for, or deserved. And I thought maybe I was the only one who had not heard this phrase, so I did a quick search, and I will tell you, no one knows about this phrase, to the point that I was actually so sad when I did a search, and the whole first page of hits that comes back when you search for gospel measure, it's nothing about abundance. In fact, it's all about definitions of boundaries. The idea that the gospel is this measuring stick and to be very careful to not go outside or beyond it. And I was so sad because a phrase that once meant undeserved abundance now means cautious reluctance with an eye towards reductionism. Let's live by the old-fashioned gospel measure. Let's live by a gospel that is just overly gracious and abundant. So, with that in mind, Reverend Wynn talks a lot about greed, the squeeze of greed. We find this concept in 1 Timothy chapter 6 really well spelled out for us. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. From nothing to nothing. It's a very humbling thought, this idea that we brought nothing into this world and we can take nothing out of it. We hear an echo of that in the words of Job in the opening chapter of the book of Job, where he's beginning to experience these incredible challenges and tragedies when he says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return." Now, there are two ways that this thought humbles us. The first one is that we bring nothing into this world. When you enter this world, you bring nothing with you, not even clothing. You arrive with zero, zip, zilch, nada. You have nothing. You have no claim or right to any possession whatsoever. No wealth at all. When you enter this world, you start with nothing. Nothing but, as they say, your birthday suit. That's all you've got with you. That's it, nothing. But then there's the complementary idea that you take nothing with you out of this world. Maybe you've heard the phrase or the idea that you'll never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul trailer because you can't take it with you when you go, right? So you'll find it interesting that Christian recording artist David Crowder a few years ago posted on social media and said, "Well, now I can't say anymore that I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul trailer," because in fact he was able to snap a picture of exactly that. I think that this one is actually far more humbling than the first one. The first one, that we all sort of enter on an even playing field. We all enter with sort of this innocence of, we just enter with nothing. We're okay with that. But for all the time and effort and energy we put into the accumulation of stuff, shouldn't we be a little offended at this half of it? That nothing goes with us? That is so humbling. If our ability to possess anything stops at death, then we really need to re-examine how much of our life gets expended in the pursuit of possessions. If it's actually true that you don't take it with you, if it's actually true that you're not going to hook a U-Haul up to the hearse, if all of those things are accurate, then man, we really need to think about how much of our time and our energy and our devotion we put toward the accumulation of stuff, the pursuit of possessions. It's such a brief stretch of time that we can possess much of anything in this life. Think about your early years. I mean, as a child, you don't have an opportunity to possess too many things. You don't have a job. You're not out earning money. You're not buying your own stuff. You have to rely on your parents, who give you everything you need, and your grandparents, who give you everything after that, because they spoil you constantly. At least that's my experience. But you only possess your own stuff. So it's not even until later in life that you start out with your own possessions. It's such a short window, a short time of possession. But there is something that you and I do possess as soon as we enter this world, and we carry with us the entire time we walk through life, and that does go with us when we leave, and it's our soul. And we're going to find out in just a few moments that it's true that the squeeze of greed is one of the things that can distract us from acknowledging our souls, appreciating our souls, and attending to our souls. So let's think first about this time of possession, the window in which we can even own anything. And I typed that phrase, time of possession, this week into my notes, and I immediately thought, it's football season. We've finally made it. Guys, Notre Dame played yesterday. College football was on. We're less than 2 weeks away from the Browns probably losing their first game, most likely. That's how those things go. So I did a little dive this week into time of possession. How much does it actually matter? So if you're unfamiliar with football entirely, time of possession is simple. How much of the clock time do you have the ball and are possessing it on offense trying to score versus how much time does your opponent possess the ball? How much does it actually matter? Turns out, actually, it matters quite a bit. There is a decently strong correlation between time of possession and winning a game. And if you are a statistician, you know a lot more about these things than I do, but I think 0.54, not a super strong correlation, but actually one that is significant enough. So to put it in terms we will all understand, we're going to look at between the year 2000 and 2016. So a huge sample size of NFL games. Every NFL game has 60 minutes in it. Everybody's fighting to possess the ball, to have the better time of possession in those 60 minutes. And here's what we find, well, not we, somebody else found, and I just gleaned the results, that if you possess the ball for 35 or more of those minutes, you have an 837 winning percentage. That's really, really high. You're winning more than 80% of your games. And there were only 86 games, only 2% of all the sample size, where a team had the ball for 40 or more minutes, and they were 80-6, a 930 winning percentage. You rarely lose if you have the ball that much. So think about that. 30 is half. You only need slightly more than half of the time of possession to have a really, really increased chance of winning the game. Slightly more than half time possession gets you way over half, way over a 500 record. So time of possession actually matters. But what matters more is what you do with it when you actually have the ball. We have a short window where we possess things. But what are we doing with our stuff? How should we practice this idea of ownership? I have three ideas. The first one is this. Don't act like an owner. First of all, acknowledge that we are simply stewards. That we hold things so briefly that we need to also hold on to them loosely. Not holding on to, whether it's worldly wealth or possessions, whatever it is, not holding on too tightly because the window is small. We are stewards only. Everything you have is a gift. Yes, even the things you have earned. Do you know why? The way you earned to get those things was because you had breath in your lungs, which was a gift every single day. You and I, we are merely stewards of all that we have. I read an article this week from Ellery Sadler, and she says this: we know in theory that everything belongs to God, but we still cling tightly to the idea that we can be in control of our own lives. In actuality, we can't control our lives, or at least most of it. You can either be left with your fingers stiff and sore from gripping tightly, or you can open your hands and let them go. And this article was about more than just possessions. It was about relationships, like holding lots of things loosely. But I love this, the visual image of when we grasp our stuff so tightly that we end up with fingers stiff and sore from gripping so tightly. That doesn't mean we drop our things. We're not careless, but we hold them loosely in this life. So acknowledge your role as a steward. Secondly, let's settle in with contentment. And contentment is such a hard thing to practice in our world. You guys, you live in a world where you are constantly being invited to abandon contentment. You are being marketed to all the time in more ways than you could ever imagine, and you're constantly being told that what you have is not enough, is not big enough, is not new enough, is not fast enough, fill in the blank with all the enough things. We are bombarded with that message. Contentment is so hard to hold on to. But it's how we are called to live. In the passage we just read, it's a pretty simple formula. Godliness plus contentment equals great gain. Godliness plus contentment, great gain. We're going to get a little Greeky this morning. It's been a while, and there are so many fun words in here that help us more deeply understand what's being communicated about the squeeze of greed. The first one, godliness, the Greek is eusebia. It's one of Paul's favorite words in his letters to Timothy. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy. Over half the times this word appears in the New Testament, it's in those two letters. That word is in chapter 6. We just read 4 times alone. He uses this word all the time in his letters, his instruction to young Timothy. Godliness. It means to honor or revere something or someone with the respect and the devotion that they actually deserve. We might say pious. To be pious is another way to understand this. To give the proper reverence and then therefore devotion to someone or to something. So godliness is part of the equation. Another part is contentment. That word in the Greek is autarkia, and it can literally be translated as self-sufficient. Now, we use that phrase kind of negatively in our world, you know, or at least pridefully. I'm going to be self-sufficient. But the intention here is that you already have enough. You have what is sufficiently necessary for the life that you live. The word is only used here and one other place in the entire New Testament, and we find it in 2 Corinthians chapter 9, where we read, God is able to bless you abundantly so that in all things, at all times, having all that you need, you will abound in every good thing. There's a similar word that's used also in Philippians 4 where we read, I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. It's a word that's connected to the idea of satisfaction, that I have a level of satisfaction with my life, that I have all that I need. And I love it when the Bible so closely, as it does here, links the vertical and the horizontal together. Godliness plus contentment. Proper reverence and devotion for God will help us develop contentment in our lives. At the same time, as we develop contentment, we realize everything we have is a gift, and we thank the God who has given all good things to us. They build and feed off one another, giving us forward momentum into great gain. In the Greek, it's porismos. It means a source or a means of gain or even profit for the sake of a livelihood. It's a sustained, profitable living. So if I were to sort of creatively rewrite the formula today, I might do it like this. Reverent devotion plus steadied sufficiency equals life profit. Do you want a profitable life? If you do, then you need reverent devotion for the God who gives life, and you need a steadfast sufficiency, a heart that is content. And this passage even helps us understand what contentment looks like. Did you catch what contentment is shaped like in this passage? If we have food and clothing, that will be enough. That is such a low bar in our world. If we have food and clothing, if we have the essentials, then that will be enough for us to be content. I don't know about you, but the world I live in is constantly tempting me beyond that to say what I actually need is that plus these things in order to actually be content. If we're going to settle in with contentment, we probably should try and do so with a biblical understanding of what contentment even looks like to begin with. And there are dangers if we have contentment poverty. If we have a lack or a loss of contentment in our lives. And there's some great descriptors in the passage. Want to get rich, love of money, eager for money. That original word there for lover of money is like love silver, a lover of silver. And my favorite one is the part about eager for money, because in the original language, it's oregomahi, and it literally means to stretch yourself out as far as you can, especially with your hands, to stretch yourself out, to reach for something that is actually beyond you. Which really connects, I think, to the way we talk about greed in our own lives, or the way, the directionality, because how many of us have thought or even said, wow, that person or that family has stretched themselves out beyond their means, leaning, stretching in order to grasp something that we feel that we need, even if we don't actually need it. There's a scene in the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade where the Holy Grail is just out of reach for Indy, right? And yes, it's the end of it. Look, if you haven't seen it yet, it came out in 1989. I have no apologies at all for you. But near the end of the movie, they've been seeking after this Holy Grail, and it's fallen on the other side of this chasm. And Indiana is reaching and straining for it while being held steady by his father on solid ground. And he keeps reaching and straining and stretching, saying, I just need to go a little further and I can get it. I can grasp it. I can hold it. And do you remember what it takes to get his attention to go back to solid ground? His dad says his name. And when his dad says his name, it awakens him to what's actually really important. And he scrambles back up and he leaves it behind. Are we reaching and stretching ourselves so far that we're in danger of losing solid footing? Now, this is not, to be clear, this is not anti-earning a living. This is not anti-having a savings account. This is not anti-even investing for your future. Please, let's be wise in the way that we steward what we have. But can we do so without reaching and stretching and straining and putting ourselves on uneven footing and not having the support that we need? Because what happens is we fall into temptations and traps, we're told in the passage. It's a trap. There are foolish and harmful desires that are coming after you. It's always, when you have Indiana Jones and Star Wars on one day, it's a great day. So if you are told about a trap ahead of time, you have way better chance to navigate and get around it and safely avoid it. And Scripture is literally telling us there are traps and temptations that go along with this squeeze of greed that you can be on alert for. Are we actually paying attention to the traps and the temptations so that we don't fall into them? Because if we do, and I love this language, we can plunge ourselves into ruin and destruction. If you have the King James Version of the Bible, that word plunge is rendered as drown, because the word plunge in the original language, buthidzo, is about, they would use it in the context of a ship that would be sinking and submerged and fall all the way to the bottom of the sea. Which again, connects with how we talk about these things today. How many times do we know of people or experience ourselves to be sinking in debt or drowning in debt? To be submerged, to be plunged into ruin because of the squeeze of greed. It talks about being pierced with many griefs. That original Greek word is the one they would use if they would put an animal on a spit to roast it over a fire. I found some incredible pictures of a pig roast. I'm not going to show you any of them because some of you would get really grossed out at the pig roast pictures. Some of you would just get hungry. So I'm not going to do that to either group this morning. But the image of being pierced all the way through because the pursuit of possessions just takes up so much of our time and our efforts and our energy. I love it that Reverend Wynn compared it to a boa constrictor. It's actually a fantastic metaphor for what the squeeze of greed can do to us. I found myself asking, how hard does a boa constrictor actually squeeze? I did some research and I found the answer. I'm going to show you the answer. Hide your eyes. If you are a snake squeamish person, there'll be a picture of a snake. I want to give you plenty of time to look away because the answer to how hard they squeeze will be on the screen, but also a picture of a snake. Okay, you've had enough time. If you measure with PSI, it's between 6 and 12 PSI that a boa constrictor can use its muscles to squeeze, right? Does that help at all? It didn't help me, because like I don't know what that means. I don't know compared to what. So I found some comparisons, right, to make it easier and so we can get the snake off the screen. So here's a couple of comparisons to give you an idea of how 6 to 12 compares. The average hand squeezing your hand as hard as they can, about 100 PSI. A dog bite, 250. A boxer's punch, between 1,200 and 1,700. A crocodile bite has almost 3,000 PSI. So all of you that are afraid of snakes, you should be afraid of crocodiles way more. Way more. More teeth, more pressure, more of all the things. So compared to 6 to 12, but here's what's fascinating. And I don't know how much of this Reverend Wynn might have known or not known. Here's what's fascinating. It only takes between 5 and 10 PSI to create problems for the arteries and the veins in your neck. It doesn't take much. And that's such a great example of how sneaky the squeeze of greed actually is. It wraps itself around our lives, and we say, that's fine. I feel fine. Everything's fine. But then slowly there's more and more coils. Slowly the pressure gets more and more, and pretty soon life is being squeezed out of us because of this threat of greed. And the ultimate loss is more than just temptations, more than just traps, more than submerged in ruin and destruction. Did you catch the ultimate loss? Is that it can sometimes lead to a wandering from the faith. Guys, I don't think we actually believe this. I don't think we do. I don't think we connect the idea of this squeeze of greed with actually wandering from the faith. In fact, I would say if you ask 100 Christians this question with a blank in it, some people eager for blank have wandered away from the faith, what would they put in that blank? What are the most common things that cause people to wander away from the faith? This is ripped straight out of the Bible, but I bet you most people would not give the actual biblical answer. And do you know how I know that? I did a search. I just did a search for this phrase to find out what do most people say is the cause of wandering from the faith. Here's what I found. People stop attending church because they have guilt about ongoing sin. People go through intellectual skepticism. In other words, they have to go through difficult questions and they wander from the faith. Or they're blinded by fear. Or they start to trust their feelings too much instead of the truth. And so they wander from the faith. And I'm sure that's true for some people. But the answer is actually in our Bibles. And we ignore it, or at least pretend that it's not all that true. Think of all the isms that somebody would tell you are threatening to the Christian faith. Pick whatever ism you want. I don't care. I'm not going to start naming them. There are lots of isms out there that we say, oh, that's dangerous. People, because of that ism, will start to wander away from the true faith. Do you know which ism we almost never talk about? Consumerism. Almost never. We ignore it. We don't believe that it has the ability to squeeze the life out of us, even though it's plainly taught on the pages of the Bible. Research bears this out. I found this week there are some recent surveys that suggest two of the most important things parents say they want for their kids: financial stability and career satisfaction. The desire for their children to share their religious faith, 35% compared to 88%. We don't believe it. We don't believe that it can actually cause us to wander away from the faith. Which brings us to sort of my final conclusion, the words of Jesus himself in Matthew 16, when he simply says, "What good would it be for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul?" Because don't forget, there is something that you enter the world with, that you carry with you the entire journey, and that will stay with you on the other side of life. And the truth is that the squeeze of greed so often distracts us from attending to our souls. So with that in mind, a few things for us to think and pray through and reflect on as we finish up studying Scripture together. Here's the first one. Which is more challenging for you, maintaining a reverent devotion for God or maintaining a steady satisfaction with your possessions? Because those things together are what brings us great gain, a profitable life. Second, are you eagerly stretching out for something you desire but haven't yet attained? And is it causing you to lose grip on solid ground or support? Third, are you drowning in debt or financial instability? Ask the Holy Spirit to give you wisdom to overcome and find a trusted friend to help you figure things out. And lastly, pray for someone you know who, according to what you're observing, seems that maybe they're exchanging their soul in order to gain the whole world. I'm going to flip through those one more time while I stop talking so we can all allow the Holy Spirit to speak to each one of us, and I'm sure teach us something each different through these reflections in this time, and then we'll finish that up in a moment with a word of prayer.